Hello, my name's Graham Alcott. Welcome to another episode of Beyond Busy, the show where we talk productivity, work-life balance, defining happiness and success, and much, much more. On this episode, I'm talking to Dave McQueen, coach, contrarian, all-around interesting guy, and I think you're going to really love this episode. We talk Black Lives Matter, we talk leadership, we talk successes and failures in business, we talk telling hard truths to organizations and loads more, just so much to take away from this episode. So I think you're going to really enjoy it. Quickly before we get into it, so I have just started up this mailing list over the last few weeks. I'm on week 10, and if you go to grahamalcott.com, you can sign up there. We're now over 500 people. It's been a really interesting journey over the last few weeks, just having the deadline every week to write something useful and positive. So the idea is, it's called Rev Up for the Week. And the idea is, it's like one positive thought to take into the week ahead. It goes out every Sunday. If you want to sign up, grahamalcott.com, and you'll find the little form to fill in right on that page. If you haven't yet subscribed to Beyond Busy, I'd love you to subscribe. And also, just to let you know that you can get show notes, previous episodes, lots more at getbeyondbusy.com. So just go to getbeyondbusy.com and let me know what you think. If you want to drop me a line as well, graham@thinkproductive.co.uk. Right, let's get into this episode recorded in lockdown. I've got this list of, there's probably about 15 people on the list who pretty much since I started Beyond Busy, I've really wanted to have on, and just for some reason haven't got around to tapping them up for episodes. They're generally people in my network that I sort of know. Dave was on that list, and we connected, sort of reconnected recently, really, over the video that Dave did, Centering Black Lives, which we're going to talk about in this episode, which I just really loved and shared on my mailing list and elsewhere. So let's get straight into the episode. Recording lockdown. Here's myself and David McQueen. I just realized as well that as I press record that I didn't check that all our microphone tests have been done, but it looks like they have.
Yeah, it works. It's working fine with mine.
You're sounding loud and clear. I'm with Dave McQueen. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you, Graham. Good to be here. Finally.
Finally. Yeah. Do you know what? I've had, there's about 10 or 15 people who've been sort of on my Nosby list for a long, long time. And you're one of them. So it's nice to make it happen.
All good. All good.
And tell everyone just where are you in the world? Just paint a picture of where you are right now.
So I live in a village. Are you talking about location or mentally? Which one? Or both?
Well, let's start with location and then we'll do mentally after that.
Okay. So in terms of location, I live in a little village not too far from Watford in Hertfordshire. And I live there with my lovely wife and two children. And you want to jump into the mentally one now?
yeah. Because I saw your thing on Instagram this morning saying that it said today was emotional. And it sounds like you had a big day yesterday.
It was a big day. So essentially, because we'll jump into this, because a lot of organizations are acutely aware that their approach around that one taboo area of diversity being race and ethnicity, because a lot of people have avoided it, now they have to actually deal with it because it's in the spotlight, has meant that a lot of work around my leadership culture or inclusive cultures has meant that I'm doing a lot of work around race and inclusion. And yesterday I was working with a client, I had a focus group and I had a town hall that I was facilitating. And essentially what had happened with some of the conversations, it had triggered some uncomfortable feelings. And it just reminded me that for a lot of individuals who didn't understand what the experiences for a lot of Black professionals, the kind of language or expectations that they have, it triggered quite a lot of stuff in the group. And so there was an outpouring of me trying to be this independent facilitator, but my empathy, kind of natural empathy thing, just really kicked in.
Yeah.
And what was essentially going to be a 1 hour session ended up being 2 hours. And I left there just absolutely exhausted.
Wow.
And I sat in it, it was, a bit discomforting. And especially when you are in a position as a coach or a facilitator, one of the things you try to do is distance yourself so that you spend you want to be present, but you want to make sure that you are slightly emotionally detached from, you know, the clients in front of you. But yesterday it hit in and I was just like, okay, I'm not going to run away from this. Let me just sit in it. And I did, and had a good think about it last night. Went for a walk this morning, for a couple of kilometers, spoke it out of my system, and yeah, we bounce and we move on to the next one.
Yeah. And what can you say a bit more about what were people expressing? What were some of the things that you think is shifting right now?
So there were instances where and it's happened with a number of clients where individuals have been very forthcoming about language that has been used to them around race race and gender, and the expectations of individuals who have not come from the same background. So literally, I think we are hyper aware in the UK, I would say, in metropolitan areas about the language and the acceptance of language we can use. Whereas when individuals have come outside of the UK, whether that's from mainland Europe or other areas where people are not as the conversation around race and ethnicity, and even the words that you can use are not as familiar.
Yeah.
And so when they do use words that are outside of the scope and not realizing the impact that it can have on people, it can be, as I said, it can be quite triggering if you don't feel in that organization that there's somebody or somewhere you can go to go, look, this was totally inappropriate. This person said this and we need to be able to deal with it. You know, I was talking earlier in the week with a potential client who was saying, you know, they have quite a lot of amazing young professionals who, again, in this instance, were from mainland Europe, who would use phrases because they felt it was acceptable because they heard it in a hip-hop song and didn't know it was wrong to use it in discourse when you're talking to colleagues or in front of a client. And whilst my instinct or default instinct is really, you don't know that, I think part of it is taking it as a teaching moment to ensure that people are aware of what policies do you have in your organization or what approaches or narratives do you have as a leader to make sure that people understand this is not acceptable while we're working with this, whether it's in the UK or globally, this is not acceptable. And if this does raise, we will challenge you on it. And if you continue with that behavior, you know, we will probably have to develop policies around zero tolerance. So you know from the get-go that kind of damaging and demeaning language, you know, telling a black woman with locks or longer hair that, you know, that it's unprofessional, and that, you know, that your hair shouldn't be down and all that kind of stuff, and somebody having to bite their tongue so they don't respond. That stuff for me it's important for an organization to take ownership of that.
Yeah.
And say, look, if we are working and serving a global stakeholder base, it's important that we understand the language and the behavior and the values to reflect that stakeholder base and be very conscious of what we say as an organization.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk in the last few weeks. We're diving straight into Black Lives Matter and just that whole conversation that's currently happening around race. And I want to talk more about your career and stuff. So I'll ask this one question and then we'll maybe come back to it. So there's been a lot of talk in the last few weeks around education, right? And people have been sharing lists of books and sharing talks online, and it's almost become, In some ways, I find it sometimes a little bit uncomfortable how on social media it's become this like very fashionable thing to say, I'm listening, I'm reading or whatever. And to me, there's an element of that, which is like, sort of like, don't forget me, like I'm in this too, sort of thing. You know, there's always a slight, wish to not just be participatory, but to be seen to be participating in it. But like, what do you think about like the best route to education? Because like a lot of people have been sharing books, and I wrote something in my newsletter a couple of weeks ago that basically said, you know, and I was saying, realistically, a lot of people, if you've got kids at home in lockdown right now, like you ain't going to be sitting there reading books. Like far better to like watch an hour long thing on YouTube or, you know, really take some time to do something rather than buy books that sit on your shelf that you don't do. So I'm just wondering, like, if you think there are other, it sounds like you had you really helped your client there with creating a space for education yesterday. But like, are there other ways that education can happen that, that you think are being underlooked or undervalued right now?
Yeah, so I think one of the things about the books, again, like you said, it can be quite performative. It would seem like, you know, I have read this book, so I understand it. But, you know, I think of two of the most popular books that have been recommended, and Natives by Akala and Why I'm Not Speaking to White People About Race by Rennie Edo Lodge. And two of the biggest challenges around those books is that they viscerate the British Empire. And they literally, they don't leave any stones unturned. And if you are, for the sake of argument, part of the majority white population who have not necessarily had an understanding of that or exposure to the black experience, that can be quite disorientating. You know, we see with the kind of like kickback that has happened with Churchill and the statues, and individuals are like, you know, this person was a hero, you know, we shouldn't be changing our history. And we're like, no, that's okay. I think it's important to recognize that this same hero can be quite problematic. And it's all right to see people doing something good, but it's quite problematic. And what I guess is missing in this space is the point of dialogue. And I think, you know, like anything, you can go away and read it, but you can still have your blinkers and biases on.
Yeah.
If you still feel it's problematic. You know, one of the things I did is I really wanted to create some spaces where I would just take some questions from individuals and point them in the direction of what some things might be problematic around discussing around race and what kind of could be the way going forward. So I think it is a combination of reading. I think it's podcasts. I think it's being able to go and look at videos online where you're pointed to. I think if you're in an organization where your work will at some point, you know, touch or affect people from a Black African Caribbean background, is to be able to create those spaces to talk honestly. And without going too deep into my work, there's a little framework that I use, and I share it quite openly. And I say that if we're really going to move the conversation forward, there are four approaches to it, because a lot of people come to it from fear. So I have an approach called the L4 approach. I say, let's approach it in love. So essentially, we want to have a conversation, drop, you know, all this, we don't want to start a conversation with no offense or, you know, all these kind of things that actually cause offense to begin with. Let's come from a place that I don't want you to be afraid to talk about this. So I'm going to allow you to speak, and you will allow me to speak, and we will both listen, but with the intent that we're doing it from a place of love. We don't know. We want to know better. The second one then is being able to be okay about the language that we use. So, you know, all these terms that are bandied about, like, white supremacy, white privilege, BAME, Black Lives, all this kind of stuff. What does it actually mean? And what do we mean, you know, when you innocently say, I don't see color, what does that mean to a person who has heard that for so many times? And it's a demeaning character to say that you don't mean me. What does that mean when we start to have those discussions? And then the third one is about listening. How well are we actually listening? Are we listening because we just want to push out our own opinion? Or are we listening because we actually want to hear what the other person is saying? And, you know, for me personally, there are a number of, I may have said this online, but there are a number of friends within my circle who are quite close, but had never really heard or understood the term of white privilege. And especially as they came from a background where it was working class and they worked their way up. Yeah. So that language piece was, okay, this is what it means to me. Let's have a discussion about it. Let's see exactly where you're coming from. And then the last L was about leverage. How do we take the lessons from loving, from listening, and from language? And how do we leverage that and go, okay, now what are we going to do with it? How do you as an individual who may be really weird or weary of being accused of being racist, which is I've got no point, you know, unless somebody's really blatantly triggering people, I've got no truck in or no desire to call somebody racist. However, I think there is a point about understanding what anti-racism means. What does that look like for you to represent when I'm not there? In the same way that I know that when I'm talking to individuals about the language that they use around LGBT plus and no LGBT plus persons in the room, what are those things that I need to do in order to be able to represent my allyship? Or if there's a woman who's not in the room and guys are being really misogynistic, what's the language or what's the framing that I use to make sure that they are considerate of women as well? And so it's that kind of approach for me, I think, whether it's in the organizational learning or the individual learning that we have, it's being able to tap into all those different modalities. But most importantly, I think it's about having a conversation where possible, having a conversation to understand people's experiences.
Yeah. I feel like we're on this topic and I want to continue on, actually. I know we'll come back to talk about your various many things that you're doing. So the thing that really struck me about that was the whole thing about approaching the conversation from a point of love.
Yeah.
And I think there's an awful lot of fear around how a lot of people approach this, right? So you have like people who are scared to say the wrong thing. You have people who somehow fear change and kind of, you know, that whole all lives matter rhetoric is really based in fear, isn't it? It's like a fear of things changing or one group having more of a spotlight on them than their group or another group or whatever. Do you know what I mean? So I think there's something really powerful about starting a conversation where both of you agree to head into that conversation from a point of love. I think that's a really powerful thing. How's the last few weeks been for you? Because obviously you've been doing work around leadership. You've been doing work around diversity for a long time.
Yeah.
But it feels like as a subject matter, it feels like it's more in the spotlight now than it has been in certainly in my lifetime.
Yes.
In our lifetimes. And do you have a sense of like, oh, you know, thank goodness everyone's talking about this. Like, do you have a sense of, no, but a lot of people are missing a trick here. Like, are you energized by it? Are you tired by it? Like, how is it just for you personally in terms of seeing this subject matter come to the fore so strongly as it has?
It's a wave, if I'm really honest, Graham, it's a wave of emotions. There are sometimes you know that I'm quite vocal on a platform like LinkedIn. That will be my space where I really encourage dialogue. And one of the things I realize is that there are individuals who come into those spaces who haven't seen or understand my mode of communication or come in and they will just not read the room. They will not read it at all. I'm like, it's on my profile. Go and read it. I say I'm outspoken. I say I encourage debate. And one of the things that has been, I guess, tiring on a platform like LinkedIn, for example, it's been individuals who you'll place information in front of them, but they've projected their own meaning onto it. So I'll give you one example. One of the things I said, you know, there is a lot of emotional baggage that comes with this. There are individuals who all their working lives have suppressed and toned down or quietened down their voices, their whole character. You know, this whole bring your whole self to work. People are like, no, how will that ever happen? If my go-to in terms of work is not psychologically safe. And so I raise the point around this and saying, you know, I don't believe in this whole concept of bringing your whole self to work. And I gave a number of reasons. I was saying, look, how can you do that if it's not psychologically safe? If I come into work and somebody immediately questions my hair or my laughter or my tone or doesn't want to be able to take the time out to pronounce my name, how is that me then being able to bring my whole self? Because my whole self will be, look, if you come and disrespect that part of my identity, I'm going to pull you up. And I'm going to say, no, this is how my name is pronounced. What do you mean by my hair is unprofessional? What do all these things mean? And so for me, bringing that whole self and the concept of the whole self is very idealistic and it's really bathed in privilege as well. And I'm saying to individuals, look, I'm working in this space. I've been working in this leadership space for the best part of 15 years. You know, originally it was a lot of it was in the education space. And then I moved more into the corporate and the third sector. But, you know, as I say, we're all kids. Just this time around, we're kids with mortgages. same issues that we're actually facing. But you'll see individuals come in and they'll argue their point. And I remember I said one thing to, I said something to somebody who was having a discussion with me. I said, look, I'm always willing to learn, but I think it's important to understand where I'm coming from. So I mentioned that, you know, the London Business School has done 50 years of evidence-informed research around how we bring ourselves to work, our different modalities, using the organizational psychology. So we'll tap into clinical, educational psychology, anthropology, and all these things, you know, this big mix that it's not just an opinion. This is the fact. This is based on data. And, you know, and I'm saying, and that's the approach I take, you know, when I'm saying to individuals to bring their work self, which can be a part of who they want to represent at work. There are going to be some parts that they don't want people from work to see. This contributor really dismissed all the data and then brought in the opinion. And at that point, it just made me tired because I just was like, you know, are you actually listening? It's this kind of shutting down of a conversation that is problematic to begin with.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, as I say, I'm not out here trying to say that I'm right, but I'm thinking if you're going to have a robust conversation, let's have that. But then on the flip side, I also put out a post where I was saying that I think it's really detrimental to teach your child or children that they need to go into work and work twice as hard as someone else. I said, because that starts from a deficit narrative. Yes, there's privilege. Yes, there's racism. Yes, there's class. But if you go into a situation of work already feeling that you've got to work twice as hard as the other person with no data or no means of measuring that, you're already on the back foot.
And the phrase often, right, is twice as hard for half as much.
Yeah. How negative is that as a mindset to start working? How do you really enjoy the work that you're going to do if the framing for that kind of conversation is that you're going to, again, as you said, you have to work twice as hard for half as much?
Yeah.
That's indentured servitude, for want of a better phrase, you know. I challenge that. And then, you know, somebody came back to me and they said, you know, they came with a race angle and they just said, look, you know, you're coming from a point of privilege. And so, you know, you doing this and saying that, what about people who come from poorer backgrounds? And I was saying, look, I make no apologies about the fact that I've come from privilege. But one of the things I've learned being in a privileged position is you learn how to navigate work. You work hard, you work smart, you build a network, you stay in your lane. And you learn how workplace politics actually happens, because this is what I do all day long.
Mm.
And then again, that was dismissed based on an opinion rather than the data from myself and other practitioners. And again, I'm not necessarily saying what I'm saying is the gospel. It's obviously my truth. But when you're having this debate, you realize a lot of this stuff, like a place like LinkedIn, it really spotlights some of the issues or the challenges you have in the world of work, because people will put down what are serious issues because in their opinion, they don't necessarily agree with it. But on the flip side, I will say it has been incredibly energizing because there have been a lot of people who have said thank you for, I've had a lot of individuals on in terms of race, in terms of gender, and from very different backgrounds who just said thank you very much because what you've done is you've allowed me to understand where this comes from. You know, I've had what I would call very intelligent people that I would assume are very intelligent people on my timeline and in the wider network saying thank you for explaining All Lives Matter, because I just didn't understand that the Black Lives Matter thing. I just didn't get it.
Mm.
And I've had to be able to go, let me park. My initial response would be like, really? To replace it with, okay, do you know what? I'm grateful. If it took you this long, at least you've got it now.
Mm.
And that's been incredibly energizing, and seeing people find the words and find the way to be able to communicate how they want to help or how they want to be part of the solution. For me, that has been incredibly, incredibly rewarding.
Nice. And I think what's also interesting is if you are helping a sort of, you know, penny drop around something like All Lives Matter on LinkedIn, it's probably worth just reflecting for a second on the fact that LinkedIn probably isn't a platform that really encourages that deep listening. Coming back to your four ways to approach the conversation thing and that idea of, you know, really truly listening.
Yeah.
Most people while they're on LinkedIn are scrolling through, they're probably looking at emails or things are popping up on the screen on their phone and they're thinking about something else. Do you know what I mean? Like it's not a place where someone is ordinarily gonna sit and only focus on your words in that moment.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess if you're having those kind of interactions and making changes there, then that's probably a real kind of testament to the way you're using words, because it kind of doesn't feel to me like the most obvious place where that can happen, if that makes sense.
Yes, no, definitely. And I always look at it that this conversation is bigger than me.
Mm.
And so there are, you know me personally, and you know, so one of the things I've had to practice really hard is impulse control, because literally I you stupid plum, can you not read this thing? But then I realized there are bits of it where, you know, there has to be an element of restraint. Even that, I'll say, Graham, even that is a lot of emotional baggage.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're cognizant that if you do go for somebody and just say, you know, that's really stupid, you haven't really thought about it, and that will be the default mode, you're really conscious that what you don't want to be seen as is aggressive or this tall black guy who's angry. And so all that kind of, it's as I think it's a W.E. Du Bois would call it, double consciousness. Not only am I going out there into the world as a man, but I'm also having to be consciously aware of how I communicate as a black man.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, there is this civil or respectable kind of way of approaching debate that is seen as, you know, this good way of communicating. And on the other hand, there's this bit where I just want to just be raw and just say it as it is, and balancing that can be incredibly tiresome. But again, you know, as I say, the bigger picture is if there are individuals who can look at that, and I get the private messages all the time, where somebody will go, I thank you for your dignity in the way that you responded, because if it was me, I wouldn't have responded the same way. And so what it also means is that when I am offline and when I am with my family or when I'm taking away time from anything work related or social related, it's very important to switch off. It's so important to switch off so that I don't get drawn into that being my default thinking about the world, if that makes sense.
So there's what you would want to say, and then there's you almost prejudicing the prejudice by having to just think about that prejudice of like, or the archetype of the angry black guy, right? And so you're sort of saying, I'm not going to express my level of genuine anger because it would conform to that kind of a prejudice, right? So that's like on the one hand, that's like an identity where you're having to pull yourself back for the fear of scaring someone.
Yeah.
So you did this video centering Black Lives. I'll put a link to that in the show notes here. And I shared this on LinkedIn at the time, but like seriously, people need to go and watch your video on this. But one of the things you said in there that really struck me was you were saying that sometimes as a speaker, when you're traveling to places, you sort of check out foreign countries or cities or whatever, like you're checking out the news and coverage around, you know, racist violence. So like, isn't that mad that like on the one hand, you've got part of your identity where it's like, I need to stop other people being scared of me. And then there's other things where you're having to make different choices or at least add that lens in because you're scared yourself.
Yes.
And like, that's just really struck me as like, that's a lot of weight to carry, right? It's not even just on one end of that spectrum of fear. It's like both ends of the spectrum of it, right? And that's a lot to carry.
It is. I'll give you two recent examples. So I went to two Eastern European countries. One was Hungary and one was Romania. And in Hungary, myself and my wife, we were part of a conference, and you know, amazing conference, really good feedback, really good camaraderie in there. People were very open and direct. So this was in Budapest, but then we decided that we're going to go and walk because we've always heard about Budapest being this amazing city, beautiful architecture, winter markets. And off the site of the conference, we literally walked down the road, and from our apartment all the way while we were walking down, people were literally staring at us all the way, just literally staring. Wow. And like, you know, in the UK, if somebody stares, they'll give you a little glance and then they'll kind of like glance off. No,
it's like polite staring.
Exactly. This will straight through your soul, like, you know, we were looking at you.
Wow.
And part of my adjustment to that is that I had read about experiences. They said, look, when you go to Hungary, just be very aware that individuals will stare at you. You know, don't take offense at it. This is just the way that some people are and what have you. So I kind of like, I parked it, you know, because if I was going to take that on board, I would be triggered every time somebody stared at us. And likewise, I remember going to Romania and I was in Bucharest, and again, you know, fantastic conference, had really good rapport with the individuals who were there. But I remember leaving my hotel one evening and walking out and being fascinated. I'm fascinated by architecture and countries, and walking around and seeing all the relics of, you know, what Romania was like before, when, you know, the Ceausescus were in power and all the rest of it and whatnot. And I remember walking down and I got to this part, I think it's called Old Bucharest, and I walked through the space and my body froze because I walked, you know, two blocks and I walked. And people were just staring and voices went down. And I just went, okay, it's getting a bit darker. I don't know if I really want to be stuck in this little town where I don't know where I am.
Yeah.
I get back. And I double back and, you know, I walk back into the new town. And all of a sudden, I feel this weight lift off me because I feel a lot more comfortable and walk back to my hotel. But that stuff as a traveler is always going to be in the back of my mind, especially when I don't know the culture. Now, to be fair, again, it's something where wherever I go, you know, there are certain, but if I go to New York or Atlanta or what have you, I'm still want to know what are the good parts and what are the safe parts that I need to be in. But generally speaking, when I'm working in, going in a country where I know that, black people are a minority or almost, you know, not there unless they're going to do some commercial work, I will always go and check that because it is about safety. It is about making sure that I go into these spaces and have a sense of what it is and just know which places to avoid.
I also like to think of sometimes you'll rock up at a conference or something and because your name's David McQueen,
People
aren't necessarily expecting a black guy to turn up.
Yeah.
Right. So my ex, her brother is called James Campbell.
Yeah.
And when he was interviewing for university PhDs and stuff, he was telling me that like there were times where people were looking round for the white guy and it's like, no, I'm James Campbell, right?
Yeah.
So that's just another one of those things where you're having to, I guess, think about not only your identity, but how your identity is seen and perceived by other people.
Yes. And you know, I think a long time ago, I got used to the fact that there are going to be individuals who will not, because I started speaking quite early, especially as a young man and doing lots of youth conferences and what have you before I got into the corporate space. You know, there was the, you know, if I had a pound for every time somebody either introduced me or came up to me and said, hello, Steve McQueen, and thought it was funny, you know, and everybody thinks it's a joke of the day. Yeah. Like, okay, let me just humor you, you know. I'd be very rich if I charged a pound every time somebody did. but I find one of the things about that, it creates a point of levity. Because on the flip side, I've seen individuals who don't have an anglicized name and people have not made the effort to pronounce it right or they've anglicized the name itself. Okay, your name is Bola, but I'm going to call you John. No, my name is Bola. What's the difference? You know, you can say Tchaikovsky or Dostoevsky and you've got no problem with, you know, four consonants in a row when you're actually pronouncing it. I'm sure you can do something which, you know, which you are not familiar with. But I guess part of it is you, I think the phrase is you create a bit of an armor where you realize that for some people, they will be just ignorant and they'll just be, you know, that they will build in their own assumptions because that's their normal. And for others, they're just curious. So I tend to go with the default that human beings are okay people and they are the result of the environment that they come from. And so I use a lot of those moments to be teaching moments as well. So for example, people say to me, you know, where did you get your name McQueen from? And I will say to them, you know, my dad. That usually throws them off because that's not the kind of, you know, the response that they're expecting. And I'm okay with that because for me, humor creates a lot of levity, but humor also is a way of humans being able to bond. I try to put myself in that space. And even when I go onto stage, Graham, and I'm speaking, there are some times where I will use self-deprecating humor around being British, being black, and what have you, because I know there are a lot of individuals who will be sat in front of me who they're not sure. And I'll go, okay, let me just set the tone here and go, it's okay. We're going to have these conversations. You know, I'm not going to let you get away with stupidity, but let's do this. And you learn to navigate it. And, I make no bones about it. McQueen opens a hell of a lot of doors. And so I will make the most of that on the one hand, but then just be conscious that there are not a lot of people who would have processed that David McQueen could be a black guy, and I'm okay. I'll take it as an opportunity to teach them exactly who he is and what he's about.
Comes back to the leverage thing, right? Like get in the door and then do something while you're in there.
Yep.
Yeah. So I suppose I probably know you best as a speaker. Is that how you describe yourself? Because you're many other things, right? You're a podcaster, you're a coach, you're writing a book.
Yeah.
Is speaking the sort of biggest part of your professional identity?
Do you know what? I made a conscious effort, Graham, about 3 years ago to flip the script on. Because yes, I know a lot of people knew me as a speaker, but the thing I enjoy doing most is coming to my work from the perspective of a coach. And ironically, it has been for a while. So when I worked in youth work, when I trained to be a counselor, when I, you know, all the stuff I did, it was primarily what I did in those situations. I listened more than I spoke. So even when I'm doing a podcast, even when I'm doing a presentation, even when I'm facilitating, the approach I take to it is around coaching. How can I get the person in front of me? How can I listen to them well enough to make sure that I will impart information, but make sure that they walk away from here feeling that they were the ones who came up with the ideas themselves, or who came up with that way of thinking. And so quite recently, I've positioned myself more as a leadership coach. And the leadership coach informs my speaking, it informs my facilitation, it informs my writing. Even when I'm writing, and I know, I churn out intentionally, I churn out about two or three pieces of content, small content on LinkedIn in any given day, whether it's mine or others. But every single time I do that, it's very, very intentional. And it's coming from a place of, okay, let's have a discussion. I think if people knew that when I posted my stuff on there from the position of a coach, I'm going to be a bit provocative, but I need to take you out of your comfort zone and ask you a question. I think if people really were aware of that, they would have different responses to me. And individuals will follow me for a while and have seen that they get it. The penny has dropped. They're like, okay, David's on his coaching thing now. I know that's where he's going. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's it for me. I'm not going to make an assumption. I'm going to come from a place of being able to empower people through conversation. But that, for me, if I was going to go with any title or function that people would know me first and foremost, I'd like it to be from the position of being a coach.
And entrepreneur, would that be fair to say as well?
Yeah, although I think it's such a overhyped thing. Do you know what I mean? I think it's one of those things. It's a bit like the phrase thought leader.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those labels that I'm just like, I'm just going to stick with coach for now, because all these other things that come out, they just tend to be so fluffy. Yes, you know, I run a couple of businesses. I sit on a number of boards. I'm a mentor and all this kind of stuff around business. But yeah, I'll go with the entrepreneur if it gets me into a couple of doors. But otherwise, yeah.
So weird you mentioned that. Yesterday, I was writing this proposal, and I was literally asked by the person I'm writing the proposal for to describe myself, to change my biog and add in the phrase thought leader. And I have this very sort of strong belief that a thought leader should be what you call other people, not what you call yourself.
Same, right? Entrepreneur for me, yeah.
Yeah, an entrepreneur maybe has that same energy to it as well. Maybe partly the reason I was trying the entrepreneur hat on you a little bit is, so you started a thing called Legacy 71, which, right, like, you've sort of since closed and stuff. And I kind of wondered whether, because entrepreneur is all fine and well if things are going well, but then if you've had to close something, does it sort of change your relationship with that piece of identity? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell that story? Because I think it's a really, it feels like it's an idea that's maybe going to have its time again.
Yes. So the concept was, is that for many years, as part of one of the arms of my coaching was around pitch coaching, helping people to do some presentation funding.
Mm.
And it took me all over the UK and did quite a lot of work in Germany and mainland Europe as well around this. And what I found is that whenever I was doing these things, I would go in a room and I'm teaching individuals to raise money, but none of them looked like me. There were very, very few people from Black African or Caribbean heritage backgrounds. And I thought to myself, well, why is this? And then I started asking questions and people were saying, oh, they're not, businesses aren't robust enough and they don't get the markets and all this, all the other kind of responses that were filtered through various cognitive biases.
Hmm.
And so I thought, well, you know what, I can sit down and have this discussion about, you know, 1-2% of Black people getting founded, or I can just do something about it. And so I went with the intention of setting up an incubator. And again, I came from the point of it being through leadership. How can I be able to create a space where individuals were not just so dependent on funding, but they could build robust companies? And I went down the route of trying to do an incubator. And you know, I hold my hands up because I'm very, very open about being able to do things and also being able to own my failures.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't done enough work around what really was required to do an incubator. And as such, you know, you have to have very deep pockets to be a successful incubator, either attached to a university or attached to some kind of venture capital or private equity fund. And then when you realize at that point, it becomes a bit of a Ponzi scheme because, you know, realistically, there's all these mountains of money going in and you're telling people, look, you know, you can come in and you can learn how to pitch, but there's basically a gatekeeper at the end going, right, let me see which ones are the best so I can pick the ones from here that will work for our organization or our fund.
Yeah.
And having come to that, I sat back and thought, okay, how do we do this? Is it through education, what have you? And along my journey, a couple of things happened. Two or three venture capitalists and another two angel companies within the UK Black community emerged. And there were a number of other spaces who were educators, and they started to raise their profiles. So I was like, well, right about now, I don't need to reinvent the wheel because I know all the guys. What can I do within my own skill set and within the individuals around me to amplify the voices of those individuals? What can I do? So I would go to those events, or I would speak to the individuals who would have approached some of those big companies to say, okay, right about now, you need to just build a company first. Build your company, and then we can start talking about raising capital afterwards. And I was able to go into those spaces and still do, to be able to go, okay, I want to come from it from the approach of a leader. You've got a really good idea about how you're going to lead this going forward. And you and I have had these conversations before. You can start a company, but leading it is a totally different conversation altogether.
Yeah.
So for now, what I've done is I've doubled down on the leadership part of my narrative and what it is that I do. And I've said that again, as you said, you know, it's not a done deal. It's not finished, and it will reemerge in some other form. But I do believe when I do come back, it will be a lot more capitalized. There'll be a lot more money that I would have raised to make sure that this is done effectively and efficiently. And again, as I said, I want to be able to dovetail with what's already out there rather than trying to replace it. And part of the work that's going on in the background is having conversations with organizations and research bodies around how do we shift this narrative around making sure that underrepresented, not just Black, but all underrepresented sectors of the community are able to tap into the wealth, the wider wealth of what supports these kind of growing companies. So I'm happy kind of sitting behind the scenes for now as and when the time is right for me to come back out and do it. But again, you know, that underlying motivation that, you know, it's one thing to talk about this nonsense that is meritocracy. I don't believe in. And I get stick from everybody. I just don't believe in meritocracy. I've been working. I just don't believe it. I just think it's BS. I think there's so much stuff that happens. You know, both of my daughters went to a private school, and paying for them to go in was a conscious decision my wife and I made because we wanted them to start with an economic advantage. The families and friends and networks that they've tapped into being those students and being an alumni of that school is incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, as much as I understand that people will have a real issue with private schools like Eton and Harrow and all the rest of them, I'm like, okay, that's fine. I do understand that. But until the system changes, I'm going to leverage it to the benefit of my children.
Right.
You know, my eldest daughter, through networking, through part and parcel of her knowing me and me introducing her to people, you know, she's on the production set for Killing Eve. That's no accident. Okay, that's how the system works. You know, my youngest daughter, she came to me and said, Dad, you know, 2 years ago, I need to do some work experience in London. Can you ask your network? I go onto LinkedIn and go, look, my daughter needs to have some, you know, work experience in for a few weeks. Is anybody in my network able to help me? And she only wanted like four businesses to help. I think I got about 15 responses in my inbox within a day.
Yeah.
I say, this is how it works. It's not just about hard work. You have to build a network. This is how it has been from time immemorial. Yes, it's not. If you're not in that space, it's not fair. And let's be really honest about that. But I'd rather just, instead of just sitting in that space and saying it's not fair, I say to individuals, go into those spaces where it actually works. I'm happy to teach you how it works, but I'm not going to focus on it not being fair. So for me, flipping that whole thing about meritocracy was me saying, guys, I know where the VCs are. I know where the private equity companies are. I'm going to leverage my network for people who work in finance and people who work in technology, and I'm going to be able to bring that stuff together. Because if you're sitting down there thinking it's just about hard work and meritocracy, you're always going to be in that space and it's not going to move forward. You have to
be. Yeah.
So that's my kind of approach towards it.
And also shout out to organizations like Arts Emergency. We've had Josie Long on here before. And just helping to, I think there's something really powerful about opening up or sort of creating the old boys network for the people who weren't able to have access to the old boys network.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that happens in many different ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about the value of contrarian thinking and provocative thinking. One thing I noticed the other day, you put a post up saying, hey, I can help with conversations around diversity in your organizations. Here's my number or whatever. And I shared it on my LinkedIn. And one of the first responses I got was from someone who works at Uber, Eugenie, who I know, and was also saying, hey, Dave came in and did a thing with Uber. He wasn't afraid to ask provocative questions, but also to do it in a really safe and loving way. Mm-hmm. And that struck me as just as a comment that is, it's very easy to say that, but it's actually really difficult to do.
Yeah.
So I just wondered, have you always known that you're a contrarian type of thinker or a provocative thinker? Is that something you've always got energy from? Or is that like a more recent kind of thing as you went through your career, you kind of figured that out? Like, were you the contrarian kid at like 12 or whatever?
So here's an interesting story. When I was on Twitter, and I've left that cesspit now to
me too.
kinder environments to my head. My head of year reconnected, and it was really funny. He kind of like sent a message. He goes, oh, you remind me of a student at a school that I was at who was always quite outspoken and willing to challenge them. And I was like, where did you teach? And he was like, Harrow. And then I looked at his name. I was going, oh my God, that's my ex-head of year. we met up and we had this fantastic lunch, and he just started sharing some examples for me of being kicked out of geography because the geography teacher hated the fact that I said that, you know, around colonialism and exploitation of resources in Africa. He told me that I got that I remembered that I was in a detention that I refused to attend in school because I said that there was a Holocaust in Congo before there was one in Germany, and absolutely lost his head. And he said there were always things, and he said, but you always did it quite politely. And I said, I think that's what upset the teachers, because you were never angry. I got angry with friends. I never got angry with teachers. Like, with friends, I'll lose my stuff, but with teachers, I'm not going to, you know, it was always, for me, it was always wiser not to do that with adults. I grew up with this sense of inquiry. This sense of, just because you've told me that it's there doesn't necessarily mean that's right. I grew up quite religious as a in a Christian family as well, where for me, you know, there are lots of things that I was told was the right way. And, you know, I, although I define as agnostic rather than religious now, I respect people who will come from a background because I understand the kind of safety and comfort religion brings, but I will question everything.
Yeah.
Whether you are Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, or I'm questioning. Why do you believe in that one God instead of the other 3,999 that are available? Why do you want your behavior shaped around something that says thou shalt not as opposed to thou shalt? You know, for years in my church, you know, there were individuals who just didn't want me anywhere near young people because I would be like, okay, so, yeah, you may go that you disagree with homosexuality, but you're talking about a person here, somebody who's sitting in front of you, somebody's son or daughter who is bisexual, gay, whatever, and you have an issue with them because in one book of the Bible or because somebody repeats it every day, you're going to treat that person as less than human. I said, that doesn't make sense to all the other principles you have around love. So you can imagine the joy that I think people found when I was going to leave church and no longer to people with my contrarian views. But then again, it's in business. And again, you know, when I went to Uber, I basically sat down with a group of people and I just said, look, I'm here to have an open conversation. I said, the guy who founded your company is trash. Everybody knows that. He was very toxic. The environment with the boys and, you know, all that kind of stuff, it was very toxic. It was, you know, It made for a quick way of being able to make a buck, but it wasn't very respectful to women, to people of color, to the drivers who were usually going to be from poorer backgrounds to make it. And I said, it was trash. I said, let's just be honest about that. And I said, and that culture is permeated. And even though you've got a new CEO in there, it is about how do you take ownership? And I'm not going to make any bones about that. You know, if your boss is trash, your boss is trash. you know, people were like, oh, okay. I said, you don't have to say it. I said, but I'm on record. I can say it because I'm not emotionally invested in this, but I'm going to challenge
you. Although the next conversation is, here's my invoice.
Right? But it's the same. You know, earlier in the year, I went to Facebook and I said to the people who were in Facebook, I said, look, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the senior leadership of Facebook is trash. When I think about Zuckerberg and when I think about the woman who wrote Lean In, her name's gone for me now.
Sheryl Sandberg.
I said, it's trash. I said, that Lean In stuff was not, anybody who wasn't a middle-class white woman come from a privileged background, that meant nothing. That meant absolutely nothing. You honest about Lean In? Are you mad? When people are being told that you're too aggressive or this is it, non-professional. Come on now. What are you smoking? And he said, you know, Mark has built a business which basically was snooping on women. That's what you've built your company from. Own that history, because history doesn't necessarily determine the future. Own that history. Know you're working for an organization that has that as its base, and then you decide what are you going to do in terms of your work. I said, I make no point.
Yeah.
I said, you're still going to pay me because you asked me to come here. You told me to speak my truth. I'm speaking my truth. You know, and likewise, there. You know, I got a lot of stick, Graham, because I'm quite outspoken about like the Queen's Awards. So I've been shortlisted twice to be put forward for an MBE, twice for my youth work. And I said, no. I said, I don't bow before royalty. I just don't believe in it. I said, I'm a Republican. I don't believe in the monarchy. And people are like, oh my God, but this is not for you. It's for the young people. And I'm saying, you're talking trash. Do you think a young person who is just worried about free school meals and making sure that he can get to the end of the week and worrying about the trauma that his mum is going to make a difference when I walk in there and go, hi, my name's Dave McQueen, MBE. They were like, what the hell does that mean? They're like, did you play bowling?
I'm a member of the British Empire now. Right. So
that makes
sense. you should feel good about that.
Come on. So but again, as I said, I always do it from a place of love. I'm very outspoken. I'm very opinionated, but it doesn't mean that your opinion doesn't matter. I would happily, I say this while I'm biting my cheeks, I would happily sit in a room with somebody like Nigel Farage and learn mad social impulse control. Not to jump over there and smack him in the mouth. Because I still think that with freedom of speech, and I mean, his tends to lean towards, and other people tend to lean towards hate speech. But I would sit in that room and I would still listen and I would still have my proposition. Because sometimes you have to recognize that how you represent is bigger than yourself. And so again, you know, I'll be provocative and I will give really strong arguments. And, you know, I grew up reading loads of books about debating. So I know how to debate. I will debate until I run out of breath. But I will also create that space that when we're in that room, that you don't feel disrespected by me. Get upset with the idea and not the individual.
And like, listening doesn't have to end in agreement, right? I think there's something really powerful about listening. There was I remember a podcast episode a couple of years ago, which was, there's a podcast called The Political Party.
Yeah.
This guy, Matt Ford, who's a Labour supporter, but he interviewed Nigel Farage.
Yes.
And what I loved about it was he really probed Nigel Farage on, why do you think these things? I don't agree with them, but I want to understand what in your life led you to this point. And it was just so refreshing because I feel like a lot of business conversations and a lot of, you know, media conversations, news interrogations, all that sort of stuff, everything's set up in this very oppositional way, which is like either I'm right or you're right. And then we throw out all of the valuable bits of the other person's opinion because we've decided this person's right or that person's right. Yeah. Do you see what I mean? Like it's very kind of binary, and often the truth is in somewhere in the grey areas, or at least taking tiny elements of what Nigel Farage has based his opinions on, and kind of developing that argument in a different way, or like developing an idea in a different way, or sort of taking him in a different perspective. I just think it's like, yeah, I feel like, maybe there's something really interesting there about how, you're going in and having these very sort of confrontational, opinions being aired at places like Facebook. But like, surely the value is then where that takes you in sort of finding a middle ground or somewhere else more interesting.
Yeah. And I will give room to anybody to have a discussion, just as long as they are willing to see where you're coming from, but I think it's important to understand that there has to be an element of civility in it as well. We can come from very, very different points of view. Look, I understand why, if you're living in a town in Blackpool, like Blackpool in the north of England, and you are, it's effectively in the town that has the most systemic poverty in the country, and you do have the opportunities coming towards you. And then all of a sudden, you know, the news cycle is about the matching of black lives because some guy got his neck kneeled on in the US of A. And I'm just paraphrasing how this would be seen, okay? In your mind, you're thinking, hold on a minute, but why? What are we talking about this black lives stuff for when I'm up here, a white working class boy? We ain't got no money. There's drugs in here. The police are all over the stuff. Why does that matter to me? And if you're living in a bubble like London and you're experiencing the possibility of you being pulled over 9 times more as a black person than somebody who's white, or, you know, being sent into sections under the Mental Health Act, or if you're a black woman and you're going in to have a child and you know that there's 5 times the chance that you're more likely to either die in childbirth or to be treated differently, because a lot of medical students think that your skin is thicker and that your tolerance to pain is higher. There are very, very two different points of view. So in London, yes, you're going to see that Black Lives Matter thing because that's part of your experience. Whereas in Blackpool, that might be totally alien to you because that's not part of your wider narrative and experience. And for me, part of the discussion is being able to go, right, I understand where you're coming from. And I think it's important to put your point of view. And likewise, I think it's important for you to be able to understand where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I would say one of the most powerful things that I'm constantly pushing forward, especially off the back of this Black Lives Matter stuff, is, you know, on the one hand, I've been very forthright and said, look, there are lots of individuals who teach anti-racism and talk about this generally. But I believe at this point in time, in terms of leading the charge, if you really want to understand anti-blackness, I think it's important to have a practitioner whose life experience can verbalize or clearly show you what that's actually looks like. It doesn't mean that it makes your work redundant, but for now, considering how so many times people have spoken up on behalf of black people, maybe this is the one opportunity where we are at this turning point, a tipping point, where you take a back seat and allow somebody with that voice to do it on behalf of black people.
Yeah.
But conversely, and I want to put it out, this is conversely, I also think there's an incredible space for white people to be able to sit in a room and have a conversation about this, how this honestly affects them. Because on the one hand, you're going to have individuals who are liberal and who are who will think or will have the experience of working with and in and around black people and will understand it. But there will be other people who will be on the other side of the political spectrum and don't get it. And that conversation being led by a black person, or that, you know, having a black person in the middle of the room, that can be quite detrimental because some people won't speak out because they may be afraid of offending. And I think that's very important. You know, whether the community is black or white or Southeast Asian or Arabic or traveler or whatever the kind of, you know, ethnic breakdowns we have, I think it's really important that, yes, there are going to be some spaces that will be led by practitioners like myself. But there's also a need for practitioners within those actual ethnic communities to go, okay, let's have an honest conversation about the things that we've learned without having to feel that we've got to self-censor because a person of color is in the room.
Yeah.
And that for me is about, again, coming back to your point, it's about being able to go, right, yes, you may sit on, because all this I'm right wing, left wing stuff, it just means nothing to me. I'm like, I'm apolitical. I want to know what aligns with my values. And you know, if there's a political party that aligns with that, and I don't trust any, if I'm really honest, if there's the Green Party, I kind of like have a little bit of softness for that. But if there's any kind of, exactly, it's about having that conversation. And this desire, and I see it in a new generation now, where the generation before would have been, they would just shut it down. A newer generation want to cancel you. How do you cancel a conversation? That's not how it works.
So coming back to your thing about if you're in Blackpool,
yes,
and it's like, if you're in Blackpool and you see Black Lives Matter on the news every day for 2 weeks, it's like, yeah, but we shouldn't be at a place where to take that set of ideas seriously means that we're discounting another set of ideas around poverty and alienation in Blackpool, right? So again, it's like both of those things can be true.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of nuance around how those things are connected too, right?
Yeah.
To do with class and poverty and lots of other things. And it's like, I think sometimes we're so quick to shine a spotlight on one thing and automatically because of that,
yes,
sort of shut everything else down.
Yeah.
When, you know, really for me, a lot of the interesting stuff is kind of in the sort of gray area spaces, or thinking of things as like yes and rather than either or, right? It's like yes, this thing and that thing. Yeah. Like it doesn't have to be a choice. Yeah. It doesn't have to be this versus that.
Both and rather than either or. Yeah.
For sure. I want to talk about getting paid.
Yes.
So I feel like this is one of the examples of you being slightly provocative on LinkedIn and elsewhere. So there's a bit in your, I think it's in your bio, where it's like, I'm a professional speaker, brackets, that means I get paid. Yeah. And I've seen you do stuff before, which I'm sure I've sort of liked and applauded and commented on, that has said things along the lines of, if you're going to ask me to speak for exposure, then, you know, understand that exposure doesn't pay my bills or like feed my kids or whatever. So it feels like there's something really important to you in this idea of, you know, paying people properly is just like a generally acceptable and good thing to do. But just in terms of looking at organizations that have big budgets, but then say, yeah, but we don't have the budget for you for this event, for this thing.
Yeah.
So tell me more about that.
So I think it comes from my introduction into professional speaking and coaching. I'll come back to that point about working twice as hard, because unlearning that is really hard, Graham. It's a constant conversation.
Mm.
You know, I, as an executive coach, I charge at a premium. Interestingly, some people say to me, oh my God, you know, I'll be quite candid. I'll just say it out here. I charge £500 an hour, right? I'm just going to be very candid and put it out there. And there are individuals who are like, oh, well, you know, you should be charging £1,000. I'm like, no, you know, I'm good. I'm going to go. You know, I sometimes go and I get the Compera virus and I'll go and look at somebody else. I'm like, charging £25,000 for that. Tony Robbins charges how much? And I'm like, okay, well, that's his life. It's not mine. But I'm still quite determined that when I have pegged what it is that I do, I should own that value. And, you know, I've spoken at conferences where in the past, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that I go and I speak every single time I speak that I get paid. There are going to be times where I will go and I will negotiate with organizers. Okay, if you don't have the budget, okay, I want a mailing list. I want to get hold of the individuals who are the buyers in your audience. So you can either send them direct information from me, or I want to be able to get in touch with them, because I'm not giving away 30 odd years of experience for free. I'm just making know that. And what it's been, you know, I've been to a number of conferences and I say this without blowing my own trumpet. And as Muhammad Ali says, it's not bragging if you can back it up. But I've gone and we've got the feedback from conferences where I'm not the headliner by any measure. But the overwhelming feedback that has come back from these organizers is that they said that the gentleman who went up there and was very honest and vulnerable about leadership and about culture, all those points he made really made it for me. And I'm going, okay, I'm really grateful for that feedback, but you paid the headliner like 4 to 5 times more than me. You know what I mean? I remember one time I went to a conference and somebody wanted me to go and speak, and they were like, oh, you know, well, we don't have much of a budget. And I'm like, well, my fee is £5,000. That's how much I'm going to charge to be able to go and speak. And they were like, oh, £5,000, that's quite a lot. I said, you're not paying for the hour, you're paying for the years. And they were like, I like your alternative to this, but I don't think we have £5,000. I said, last year, Gokwan headlined your conference. Gokwan did not speak for less than £25,000. So if you don't have it, fine, I'll bounce. You can have a guy who can come in there and talk about squeezing breasts and getting people into dresses, or you can have somebody who will come in there and talk to the issues that you actually have around behavior changing your culture. And if I'm not with you, then fine, let's bounce. And obviously people are thrown by that. I'm not going to mention the name, but a very large software company, Graham. Okay. I'm just going to leave it there and let you and your friend figure it out. But a very large software company approached me around this time and wanted me to come in and speak to a group of people about how they navigate this time of race and inclusion. Okay? I'm just going to keep on repeating. A very large billion-dollar company. And then had the cheek to tell me that they didn't have the budget.
Wow.
For the value of your listeners, I will not swear, because just in case young people are there. But internally, I was just like, shut the front door. Really? You're going to tell me that you don't have the money? And then they wanted me to shift my diary around to see if I could have come. And I was just like, that's just arrogance. I do what I do. You're going to pay me for what I should. I said, I actually went back to the person. I said, not only should I increase my fee plus VAT, but I should charge you reparations as well for your But it's again, but there are a lot of individuals who will go to those organizations and do it because they'll go, oh, you know, this will really give me good exposure. And I go, to whom? To whom? You know, I'm not going to lie, in the last 15 years, being able to have that roster of blue chip organizations in the corporate and nonprofit sector, I know that's social proof for a lot of people who will buy my services. But I'm not going to go and do that. And I know, look, if I went to America and a friend of mine said, if you were in America, you know, you would not, no one would expect you to charge them less than 15 grand a pop.
Yeah.
Okay. But for me, again, as I said, a lot of what I do, specifically around my speaking, it's an introduction to my coaching and my programs and what have you. And even though I'm, you know, really a man who's looking to build wealth for further generations, I'm not motivated by money, but I will not have that demean the value that I'm going to bring into this. So I make it very clear. You know, some people say to me, oh, you know, wow, £500 an hour, you know, oh, so that means it's going to be 3 grand for your coaching. I don't think I can afford that. And I go, that's okay. And I go, oh, but I'd really like to work with you. And I go, that's fine, it's 3 grand. You know, I'm not going to, yeah, I don't need you to be here for me. You're coming to me for the service. And if I'm not the person for you, let me invite you to a couple of people who can help you.
So for you, it's like the money thing is really a value thing. It's like recognizing the value of your time, the value of your work, the value of that experience.
Yes, that's what it is. You know, I have the saying that I use all the time is don't expect Selfridge's quality at Primark prices.
Do you say that in negotiation with people?
Oh, no, I think people have read my stuff and they know. But seriously, you know, you don't go into, and for your international audience, you know, you don't go into a boutique store expecting to pay thrift shop prices and get the same level of quality. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, for sure. The final thing I just wanted to talk to you about, given the subject matter of this podcast, is productivity. And I wanted to just come back. You were talking about the importance of switching off before.
Yeah.
So do you have particular routines or particular ways that you manage yourself that really promote being able to switch on and switch off, and just how you manage yourself? Just like what's your kind of key bits of productivity philosophy?
So the first one for me is I don't work on Saturdays. I don't care who you are. You could be the Queen. You could be flipping the President of the United States. I'm not working on Saturday. And so generally speaking, you know, if I'm doing something for a charity or a nonprofit, I may kind of like pop my head in and do a little bit of something, but I don't consider that work. I will always consider that maybe a give back to the community or what have you. I don't speak at conferences on Saturdays. I don't do coaching on Saturdays. And a lot of that's from my upbringing. So I grew up as a Seventh-day Adventist, and it's a Protestant Christian arm, which in many ways is very similar to certain elements of Judaism. So for us, the Sabbath was from sunset on a Friday to a sunset on a Saturday. So it was, you know, even when I worked, and even when I was working in IT, and, you know, people, oh, are you going to come in on Saturday? Nope, I'm going to church, or I'm going to be off. And even though I no longer subscribe to that religion, I still have a Sabbath. And Sabbath is important for me because it's rebooting. That's my time with my quality time with my family. And sometimes people say to me, look, you know, if somebody's going to pay you £1 million. I honestly will say, okay, you know, if you're going to drop £1 million in me, I might, you know, I can bend my rules slightly. Okay. I ain't going to turn down £1 million from a family. But generally speaking, I, you know, in the main, I have my Sabbath off. And what that means is being able to just chill. Sometimes I might go into a little bit of social media, but I just sit in my sofa, or I dedicate the majority of that time to my family, to my friends, and to me rebooting. One of the other things, and our daughters enforce this more than me and my wife, but they don't allow us to have laptops in the room. They go, you can go take your phone because you can't type as fast on your phone and do your stuff. So generally speaking, I have a phone in my room, and even every now and then I'll put the phone in another room. So it's not the first thing I pick up. But trying to keep those electronic items out of there. I listen to a lot of music. I read a lot. You know, in most weeks, I try to box out at least 2 books. Some of them will be really short Kindle books, just about nothing. Others may be on economics, on philosophy, on history. Some might just be like a really trashy novel. But I try to knock out at least 2 books a week, so I'm not then just, it's not just digital. It's not online. It's not television, what have you.
Yeah.
You know, for the last few weeks, every morning I've been getting up like 5:45 and just going for a walk for 3 or 4 kilometers, and I just switch off. You know, sometimes while I'm there, I may put stream of consciousness thoughts about how I'm feeling and record that and maybe put it on Instagram later. But generally, I'm just like, I'm just out. And those routines and those habits are quite important for me, especially like the Saturday, being able to switch off on a Saturday. And one of the things that always throws my American friends as well is that I say, I have 6 weeks holiday a year. And they're like, what are you talking about? I said, no, look, I have 6 weeks. And it's insane. A lot of my, they can't, because they like have 2 weeks and loads of other public holidays. But I'm like, my body needs to stop. And when I'm ready to switch off, I'm going to switch off. And part of that was obviously being as a parent, you know, half terms, you've got 3 half terms and then you've got a summer holiday. So historically speaking, we had no choice than to have those 6 weeks off. And especially when working for ourselves. But I've made it a conscious effort. And sometimes, you know, it may go back and forth. But between 4 to 6 weeks every year, we plan our work around our holidays, not the other way around. And that's just for me, for productivity. Oh, and I have really good tools as well. So like I use Notion and Slack and, you know, and all these other different productivity tools to get me through my work as well. I'm quite systematic. So having really good software as well for me is really important to get my work done.
Yeah. What are you finding are the biggest benefits of Notion? Because I've sort of flirted with it and never really got into it, but I feel like I need to.
Do you know what before Notion, I was a huge fan of Trello. And I still like it because I love the Kanban board. And before Trello, I was a big fan of Evernote until they started doing the updates and then it went all tits up. But one of the things I love about Notion is that it's a nice place to keep both the professional and the personal.
Yeah.
And it allows me to journal, drop quick notes in there, being able to do my task lists. So instead of having a to-do list, instead of having, you know, all these other stuff, I can just literally have it in one place. I can write down my thoughts about my business. I can write down my thought about my personal stuff. And it's just a really nice container for all this stuff. And the tags, oh my God, the tags in Notion, the way that you can link the tags, whether it's personal, professional, what have you, you can link them and then being able to correlate them. That stuff is incredible. I absolutely love it. So I flirted with it earlier this year and then I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to go back into this. And I am hooked, Graham. You could tell that they really thought about the UX and they thought about the user experience as to how you were going to navigate this, whether you're using it personally or professionally. And I absolutely swear by it now.
And is the phone app good?
Yes.
Because that's the other thing, is it? So if you're going to use it to, I sort of think of it as a tool that I would drop kind of personal planning and notes and that sort of stuff into.
Yeah.
And often those things, they design it more as like Evernote, you know, it's designed more as a desktop app than it is a phone app, right? And so
yes,
then it just feels more fiddly on the phone, but it's good on the phone, is it?
Oh, it's amazing.
I never got around to downloading it on the phone.
Yeah, because you know, a lot of people, obviously, they strip stuff back. So when you're trying to replicate what you will see on a desktop online, obviously, it's obviously going to be a bit more fiddly with a phone anyway.
Yeah. But
what they've done, especially around the UX, is absolutely incredible. I say, go. Do it for 30 days and then check back to me and tell me how it's gone. Definitely. I swear by it. I definitely swear by it.
Do you know what? I was actually thinking about it earlier this week. I was like, I really just feel, I feel like there's the need to chuck a lot of this stuff into a place. I've kind of stopped using Evernote and just kind of thinking about it in that sort of way. And yeah, so maybe you've just given me the nudge to give it another go and get back into that. So I'll be coming to you on WhatsApp for a little...
Yeah, you do that.
Little tips and tricks.
Definitely happy to do that.
Sounds good. It's been such a pleasure having you on Beyond Busy. I realize we're at 1 hour 13, which may be my longest Beyond Busy for a while, but it just felt like there was so much to talk about, and full of insight and interesting stories. So just to say thank you for being on the show. Where can people connect with you? Where can they find out more about your £500 an hour coaching and and be told to shop in South
Africa? The best place to find me is davidmcqueen.co.uk. I always say, if you type in David McQueen in Google, it should come up with me in the first three. Ignore the murderer on the fourth result. You'll find me. Yeah, you'll find me at davidmcqueen.co.uk, and likewise, you'll find me on Insta or LinkedIn as Mr. David McQueen, because I deserve that title. That's where most people can find me.
Cool. Well, it's been a real pleasure. Enjoy the rest of your day. And thanks again.
Thank you, Graham. Real pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So there you go, David McQueen. Really enjoyed that one. And there's some really good ones coming up in the next few weeks as well. So subscribe to Beyond Busy if you haven't already. Also, just worth saying that if you have a team of people on furlough, you may or may not know that those people can still do training, development, other stuff around their job. So if that is of interest, then Think Productive have some really good productivity workshops for you. Think Productive are our sponsors for the show. It's my company. So that's how all that works. But yeah, if you've been enjoying Beyond Busy and you're interested in training and development and generally helping your team to become more productive, then one of the ways you can pay back all the time and effort and money that I put into this podcast would be to use Think Productive for your team's productivity training. So thinkproductive.com. You'll find out loads more there. And you can just drop me a line, graham@thinkproductive.co.uk is the email address if you want to just find out a bit more. And I can put you in touch with one of our team of productivity ninjas around the UK and around the world as well. So wherever you are listening to this Beyond Busy episode. So that's it. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thanks also to Mark Stedman, my producer on the show. Thanks to Emily, who's my assistant, doing all the sharing and general Beyond Busy evangelism. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. Stay well, enjoy the sunshine while you can, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. Take care. Bye for now.